Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine. You're listening to a new Securing Bridges podcast. You're about to join Alyssa Miller as she sits down with senior and executive security leaders to share stories of success and failure while working across business teams. It's time to build and secure the bridge to the business. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Hey, Securing Bridges faithful, here we are again. It's another episode, episode 40. We hit the big 4-0. How about that? We're over the hill or something, you know what they say. Oh, God. I'm older than 40, I have to admit. So, yeah, you know. But this is 40, episode 40. I can't believe we're here. This is awesome. And so we had last week off, you know, post-RSA, got a deep, just decompress a little bit. So we didn't have a guest last week. We're back this week, though. So if you didn't check it out, by the way, check out the recording from RSA we did with Merrill Vernon live. It was great. So if you haven't checked that out yet, head on over after we're done here today. You got to stick with us now. You're here. We're going to hold on to you. But be sure to check that out because it was a great conversation. We've gotten some really great feedback, actually, on some of the things we talked about for, you know, fostering interest in young people in STEM and bringing them into our security community. So be sure to check it out. But like I said, we're back. We're live. We're here right now with you in your living room, your bedroom, your office. I don't know where you watch us, but we're here. And I've got another great episode for you this week. We have an awesome guest, as usual. I'm really excited about this. So without further ado, let's dive in. As you can see with me today, it's Adam Shostak. Hey, Adam, how are you?
I'm great. How's it going?
Oh, I am, as you can tell, fired up. It's been a lively week, we'll call it. But really excited to have you here. But if just in case, maybe someone doesn't know who you are, can you at least introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I've been in AppSec now for 25 years, a little more even. I've been helping people secure systems, all sorts of systems through that whole time. And I think I may be best known for a couple of books, including my threat model. I can't do this with the mirror, but the threat modeling designing for security, my latest one, Threats, What Every Engineer Should Learn from Star Wars. Super excited. And speaking of bringing people into the field, and along the way, I've helped to create the CV. I'm on the review board for Black Hat. I'm an affiliate professor at the University of Washington. And I spend my days helping people and organizations get better at threat modeling, getting better at how do we build secure systems in collaboration, since this is the Securing Bridges podcast, in collaboration with all of the folks we need to work with in order to succeed. So that's a quick intro to me.
I love it. And I love that the book, right, is like right here, square center behind you. Because I think for those that do know you, it's probably really hard for anyone that's heard of Adam Shostak not to know about that book, right? So, I mean, that was like very early on, I'll admit, my first exposure to who Adam was through that book. So how did you end up? I'm actually curious how you ended up with that being like your kind of, I shouldn't say starting point, because it really wasn't, but it was like kind of a culmination of sorts. But it's when I think Adam Shostak became a little bit more of a household name in terms of AppSec.
It's been a journey, and I've been lucky enough to fall into a succession of things that helped get me where I am. And one of those, since you talked about successes and failures, is I had a startup that didn't do very well, right? In fact, did really badly, and I ended up in a rough spot in my life. And I said, I need a stable job. and found a job at Microsoft, where on my first day, my boss said, this threat modeling thing, it's not working out so well. Go fix it. It's like, okay, what does that mean, Eric? He's like, I don't know. I'm like, okay. And he said, the first thing you should do is figure out what that means and convince the people around you and go from there. And I'm really grateful to the secure development lifecycle team at Microsoft, you know, Eric, Steve Lipner, Mike Howard, a lot of great, great folks. And they gave me this opportunity to say, how do we go from being experts in doing this work to leading and encouraging and enabling? Because at the time I joined, Microsoft had like 30,000 people who were categorized as software engineers of one sort or another. You know, I've had the privilege of working on Windows, on Office, on Xbox with some of the folks at Bing, right, across these enormous projects, where even if I did nothing from sunup to sundown except threat model them, it would be too little too late. And so I had to shift my goal from being able to do to enabling other people. And the book really came out of that experience of engaging with a tremendous number of people, some very critical and confrontational, some very supportive and collaborative. Not that I enjoyed the confrontational ones at the time, but one of the things that they did was they gave me very clear problem statements once I had unpacked some of the emotion they brought in. I needed to solve the problems that they were facing with what I was trying to ask of them. And so I think the reason that that book has helped a lot of people was because of the forcing functions that were there. And the other thing that really helped that book was I wrote it for myself first.
Okay.
I wrote that book in 2008, 2009. I did the first draft.
Yep.
And then I sat on it for 3 years.
You
know, if you want to joke about waterfall projects, books are waterfall projects. There's eventually this waterfall of ink that hits the page at high speed and high pressure. And then you can't patch them. And so they make sort of natural, and you can, you know, there's awesome technology today, things like Kindles, early access editions that a lot of publishers are doing. But when the ink hits the paper, it's pretty much done.
Yeah.
And so I wrote that one really, really slowly. And then I set it aside. And then I came back to it a couple of years later. It published in 2014. And I still think it's very solid. You know, I can look at it and say, hey, maybe it's getting to be time for an update. But I'm really proud that that book has stood the test of time.
My earliest memory of interacting with you on Twitter was almost to that exact point. I think I said something about, yeah, that book has been there forever. It kind of needs some updating or something. I don't even remember how. And I remember you made the comment, you know, yeah, but it's also stood the test of time. And I think it has, you know, and I think what strikes me about the book, about that book, because I can't say the book because we've got a couple books to talk about, but you know, was that it was, I think it was my first kind of exposure to someone thinking about security in the sense more of trying to work with like business units, trying to work with developers rather than feeling like we were this oversight over developers, you know, and that's, we still have a lot of that in the industry, but I felt like when I kind of read through that book, and I bought it actually 2014, I think it was 2014, at Black Hat in the Black Hat bookstore. It was either 2014 or 2015. But in fact, it's around here somewhere. I don't know where it is at the moment. But, you know, that was one of the things that kind of struck me. And it's definitely, people have heard me talk since and know that that's something that it stuck with me. So how did that, I'm curious, you said this came out of your experiences. So I'm assuming with what you described of kind of what was going on at Microsoft at the time, that it was kind of born out of the necessity to try to connect with those same people and then influence them in a way that they were seeing value.
So I'll tell you a story about someone who yelled at me.
Oh no. Did we just lose Adam or did we lose me?
All right. So someone emailed me a question, and I don't remember what the question was. And I emailed back and I said, this book has a lot of good perspective on that question. And he very politely said, great. Why don't you write some bleeping features, you bleep, while I put my feet up on my desk and read books all day.
Wow.
It's like, okay. It's a little in your face. And fair point. He was looking for actionable advice. He was looking for a fix to his problem. And that wasn't what he got from me. Right? And yeah, it was a very in-your-face sort of message. And he might have gotten his point across without being that in your face, but his point came across. And yeah. And you know, the both about the you put your feet up, or I'll put my feet up, or whatever the exact thing was, don't matter. But also the I'm the person who's really doing the thing that gets us paid. And it's a reasonable point, right? Nobody buys a product, and I think this is changing. We can talk about that if you want, but I think nobody buys a product for security. They will sometimes not buy a product because of security issues, but by and large, we buy products that solve problems for us. You know, hey, look, I'm a product marketing genius here.
I mean, we just had Chris Roberts on a couple of weeks ago, and he and I delved deep into like the whole vendor marketing side of it. But it's a good point. You know, I mean, I don't know anybody from a CISO perspective who's out there just saying, I want to buy this because okay, maybe there are some that do because it just looks cool. But no, I mean, in reality, hopefully we are all buying products because we're trying to solve a problem. And so it's, you know, to me that it takes a great deal of two things to do what you did. One, there's a sense of empathy there, like that ability to just actually sit down and say, well, wait, okay, this person is kind of being a little crappy and, you know, whatever. But what's driving that? Why are they responding this way? A lot of people won't have that sense to do that. And the other is a sense of self-awareness to say, I might have something here that I didn't consider about this other person's perspective. So I'm not perfect and all-knowing. I should probably analyze this a bit and see how I can do better. I feel like those are two things we could probably use universally in security a little bit more of.
I think thank you. And I think even beyond security, I think we as a society have a little bit lost the idea of walk a mile in someone else's shoes, assuming good intentions. And look, you can take either of those too far, but by and large, if you start from a perspective of trying to help people, I think you are way more likely to succeed at whatever it is you want to do than if you're, let me do this. I'm gonna pat myself on the back and tell you how awesome I am. And okay, great. You know, everyone's great. Everyone's done something meaningful.
Yeah.
And
no, I 100%. And I agree with you. I mean, society just in general, the level of contempt and then responding to contempt with more contempt, and it just breeds. Thinking about threat modeling, right? To me, threat modeling has really become kind of one of those things that helps drive some of that empathy. It gets engineers in the room with security folks, in the room with hopefully business folks too. You know, and this is a thing I know. So you and I worked on a project during the pandemic along with 14 other individuals to create the threat modeling manifesto. And mm-hmm. you were kind enough to bring me in to that fold with a number of just really incredibly intelligent people. So I'm curious where that started, first of all. Second of all, I'm just going to throw this out there before I have you answer. Folks, check it out, threatmodelingmanifesto.org. It's out there. It is there for your consumption. But I'm curious, what kind of initiated that whole idea?
So I'm pretty sure that Izar Tarandok was the originator, and okay. he looped in Chris Romeo. And many of your listeners will know these folks. Izar, along with Matt Coles, wrote the O'Reilly book, Threat Modeling, A Practical Guide for Developers. Really nice book. Chris Romeo founded Security Ventures, or Security Journey. Now, and he sold that. His new company is Kerr Ventures, sorry. But they brought me in. And, you know, I thought that was just a phenomenal experience because we had a great set of folks who were able to come together with that vision of how do we present some of these, first the technical foundation, but then I think I'm really proud of the work we did together, where we represented threat modeling as a journey, a conversation, talked about the anti-pattern of the hero and how collaboration and engagement are just so important. And I really think that most of the work that we do when we engineer big projects starts with some technical core, right? We're solving mm-hmm. a technical problem in a human, a business, an interpersonal context. And if we say, you know, every now and then there is a bit of technology which is so powerful as to overcome the inhibitors in those spaces, but it's very rare. Yeah. It's much more frequent that a technology succeeds because it's embedded in the right context in which it helps lots of people, and that respect, that compassion. I think we like to pretend that the technology is just technology and gets out to people magically, and we don't talk about those things enough in my mind.
Oh, it's why we hear about things like the human element, right? Like mm. to borrow from RSA 2020 when they made that their theme. But it, you know, we talk about it all the time. Oh, the human is the weakest link, all these other crazy, you know, weird things we throw out there because we're security. We come up with all sorts of really cool cliches, but it is the reality. I mean, it's so tempting to consider technology just in its own little box and just assume that it will do its thing. And, you know, and to your point, that was one thing I really enjoyed about being there with all those incredible folks was we really, I mean, the understanding I think that even we all kind of came to, because we all had different perspectives on what threat modeling was when we walked in that door. I mean, we had some epic conversations about that, but what we produced focused so much on threat modeling's value, not just being that, oh, we created, you know, DFDs and these other things. In fact, I think we even got to the point that, you know, well, if you don't create this exact, you know, style of drawing, you can still do threat modeling. Threat modeling can be what you want it to be, but the value from it comes from the fact that you've got all of those minds talking about it and considering what the implications of that technology could be, and then trying to figure out how are we going to address those implications and make sure that they don't become something that holds the technology and our goals back from being successful.
You know, one of the, we've learned from the agile world that naming tasks, backlog grooming, retrospectives makes time for them in the schedule. And one of the things that threat modeling does is it creates time for people to come together and talk about design with a name that is not design review or architecture board or one of it's a different power dynamic. And I think that that's one of the things that, especially as we've moved to more and more agile approaches, got lost, but gets picked up because we can say we need to do a threat model sync. We need to talk about the design trade-offs that we're making, even though design's a dirty word these days. And I think that that social permission, that organizational permission to do that work is something that threat modeling both gives us and also benefits from.
Oh, I that is a great point, because, yeah, it's, you know, you say things like, what it does is it gets us out of what I talked about before, that mindset of oversight, right? It gets us away from, because you say design review. Well, that's someone's going to review this and make sure that it's up to standards, blah, blah, blah.
This design gets a C-.
Yeah, I mean, there's not value in that. I mean, maybe there is some gating value, but I hate gates. I hate gates anywhere in the life cycle of software development. I can't stand it. I think it's the worst idea. But, you know, you get out of that, and when you can sit down and say, we're going to have a conversation, we're going to talk about this design, because we want, you know, we want to understand it, we want to help you understand how you can, you know, address, you know, maybe some security things in your design, whatever. We want to highlight the business needs and where there might be risks from that perspective. All of that, when you wrap that together, becomes, it's just collaborative and, more importantly, cooperative. Yeah. You don't have people who are resistant to it. And I think that's been a big challenge I've seen with threat modeling, is overcoming people's kind of initial look at it as, oh, there's another security thing we got to do. And, you know, and people be, you know, the infamous story that I told on the talk circuit, if you will, for a while, is when I was a consultant and I went into a company and they were, you know, going through their DevOps journey, and the developer comes to me and says, I can't wait until we don't do threat modeling anymore because we're going DevOps and you can't do threat modeling with DevOps. And it was like, oh my God, no, the exact opposite. Threat modeling is like tailor-made for this. And so, you know, I that's a really cool point that you bring up. So how did all this then turn into this?
Ah, so this, Threats, What Every Engineer Should Learn from Star Wars, is a very serious book in a silly cover. And the way it turned into this was, again, somebody came to me and asked much more politely a question, which is, I was giving threat modeling training, they were in my class, and they said, where do I go to learn about all these threats? And I thought about it, and I was like, you know, I like Ross Anderson's books, so I thought about those. And I like Steve Belevin's Thinking Security book, so I thought about that. And I said, I don't think there's a really great thing. And so I went to my publisher and I said, I want to do a book on threats. And he says, that sounds like a great chapter to anchor the next edition. And I said, no, this is bigger than that. And so he says, no, I don't think it is. Prove it. And yes. Right? It's a great thing. He's like, okay, I'm going to give you a chance. Take your time, figure out if this really is. And so I wrote the first draft of the book. And the first draft of the book tried to follow the movies chronologically. And it was a failure. It was an utter failure. And so I rewrote it, and I rewrote it based, and so the idea of the book is that it's an answer to this question that I was asked, mm-hmm. which is, where do I go to learn about the threats? And so the book is focused on 9 sets of threats. It starts out with a set called Stride that people may be familiar with: spoofing, tampering, repudiation, info disclosure, denial of service, and elevation of privilege, or we might get a chance to talk.
Because I've tried to memorize that for years. I still can't rattle it off like that.
Spoofing, tampering, repudiation, info disclosure, denial of service, and elevation of privilege.
You've done this once or twice.
I have done this once or twice. And then it goes into predictability and randomness. It goes into parsing, and it goes into kill chains. And so that's my estimation of what every engineer ought to know about. And I think, to go back to the story you were telling about the person who came up to you and says, oh good, we don't have to threat model anymore. One of the things that I think happens is that we in security have forgotten our own learning journeys. And having forgotten that we had to learn this, we don't take the time to teach these are the threats. And so another piece of this journey for me was, I've got a set of courses on the threats at LinkedIn Learning. And so those are like 40-minute courses, something like that, on each of the threats. And I worked through those, and I was working through the text of the book at the same time. And I look at some of the courses out there on threat modeling in particular, and it's like they stuff the kitchen sink into it. Mm-hmm. And you end up, it's a little bit like, oh, this is Tuesday, this must be Paris, versus spending the time to really get a deep understanding of, this is why we draw diagrams. These are the diagrams that my fellow students drew. What do I like about this one? What do I like about the one I did? What am I going to learn from it? And that sort of learning, I think, is reflected in the threats book, in this new book, because I tried to balance taking the time to explain the threat without getting into the code level, because, you know, I saw something from Stephen Hawking once, and he said, every time you have a footnote or an equation, you lose half your audience. And if he can write a brief history of time without all that many equations and make it accessible, I ought to be able to write a book on threats that is also accessible. And so that was where it came from. It's a long answer, sorry.
No, that's a perfect answer, because you highlighted a lot of the things that are like, again, and this ties back to some of what we do with the threat modeling manifesto too, right? It's, first of all, just that I'm always amazed by people in security who don't take the time to teach, period. Like, just end there. Like, you know, not even teach well or teach threats, or they just don't take the time to teach. And I'm like, what do you think our function is? You know, to me, my security team, yes, do we have to sit there at the end of the day and push the buttons and click the boxes that configure the things the way we want them? Yes. But our job there is really to teach the rest of the organization, who doesn't know anything about security, or maybe knows some, but doesn't really understand the intricacies of threats and things that we're thinking about daily that we take for granted. That's our job. We have to educate them. And it's too easy to forget that. And I think, you know, we did a good job, in my opinion, and I'm biased because I was there. But in the manifesto, we talked about, and I know I think I actually fought for this a little bit, the idea that of the importance of doing something is way better than spending a bunch of time trying to make something perfect, you know. And And so I think, you know, to that point, you know, who cares if the picture is perfect? If you captured the information, that's what you need. It's not so much about having the perfectly drawn diagram. It's about why do we do that diagram in the first place? Because it lets us visualize these things.
I agree, right? The pursuit of perfection is often a mistake. And I think this is changing a little bit in our world, where the Food and Drug Administration is starting to require threat models be delivered for medical devices. Some of the new things that are happening at the federal government level, I think, are going to be requiring more and more transparency in our threat models. But that's not perfection for its own sake, as you say. That's a reason, right? You want your diagrams that you're providing outside your engineering teams to demonstrate the level of care that the reader is going to expect. This is the same reason we resolve all the little squiggles before we publish a white paper. Or, yeah, it's that finalization work. And if you need it, you need it. But we don't do it for its own sake. We do it for some customer. We do it for some reason that this thing is important.
Yeah. And that's that. Oh, that gets lost so often. The, hey, what is actually our objective here? Right.
And, you know, when I'm teaching, people ask me how far they should go. And I tell them to stop sooner than they think they should.
Yeah.
Because if they stop early and they missed something in the review process, in the socializing process where they show it to other people, those things that get missed will get caught. But stopping early is so much better than going too far and feeling you wasted a whole bunch of time.
Well, and so also, gets
them, oh, go ahead.
All right, no, finish your thought.
It gets them going. It gets them to do something and feel okay about the something they're doing, which is what you were just talking about. And then they can go further. And this is the whole agile thing, is do a little bit, then make it better, then make it better. And we can learn from how well that works and bring it to what we do. It's powerful.
Well, and here's the hidden value that people kind of don't talk about that. So it's kind of like the continuous improvement discussion, right? Like we're continuously improving. And I know that was something we talked about in the manifesto too, just, you know, iterative and always improving. There's actually value in somebody finding an inaccuracy, an omission, whatever it is. Just the act of them actually finding that has value. Whereas, you know, I mean, if you could, which obviously in reality you never could anyway, but if you could create like the perfect output, you would miss all of that. And, you know, so it's actually not a bad thing to have things that you missed, or you documented incorrectly, or it was understood improperly, and someone else has to come and say, hey, this is not how this works. There's value in it because that generates another conversation. It engages another mind in the process. And again, with threat modeling, I feel like that's what we're trying to do, especially again, when as security people, back to the subject of the show, we're trying to connect to the business and get them involved in what we talk about.
You know, even more, yes, and even more, the subtitle of the new book is what every engineer should learn from Star Wars.
Do we have to pay Disney royalties every time you say that? Or
I do not. There's a very small disclaimer at the bottom of the book that says this work is not sponsored by, endorsed, or affiliated with the makers of the Star Wars branded movies.
It's right here. It's right
there.
Here.
and so it really is focused on every engineer. And a lot of the trade-offs that I made as I engineered the book were, what does every engineer really need to know? And there are entire sections on the cutting room floor because every engineer doesn't need to know them. But if every engineer does know the things that are in the book, I think it becomes transformational. I hope it becomes transformational for those of us who work in security, because then instead of our job being review, gatekeeping, or maintaining those gates, right? Gatekeeping's got another context that we're not, no time to go into today.
Not that gatekeeping.
Not that gatekeeping. But if we can move to normal engineers understand that they need to think about the wind relative to their bridge, then they're going to build better bridges. If they understand that they need to think about their parsers as a source of danger, they're going to build better bridges and better software. And if we tell them what we expect them to know, then they can go and learn it, and they can come to us with smarter questions, with how do I make a trade-off here? And I think a lot of things like bug bounties are really a demonstration that we as a software security field are not scaling. Because if we were scaling, bug bounties would pay out a lot less.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so for me, this is, you know, I fear this is the next 10 years of my career. Is convinced? No, really.
No, I'm with you because I'm living it, right? Like I'm right there with you. And it's it is. I just, you know, AppSec is still, I mean, even in my organization, it's the thing that, you know, I think has the least amount of maturing as a community or as an industry in cybersecurity. And it's because it's hard and it evolves faster, I think, than anything else that we're dealing with.
So in the book, I use, actually one of my beta readers called me on this at the very end of the book, Jamie. She said, some places you say threats don't evolve. Some places say they do. What do you really think? And so I came to the analogy that threats are like genres of music. This is rock and roll. This is jazz. And we see new forms of jazz, acid jazz, free jazz, whatever you want to say, come out every few years, every 5 years, whatever it might be. And new songs come out every day. So there's a new song, but if you understand the genre, you can think about that new song in context. And so in that sense, things don't evolve very quickly, even though there's some new hot thing, right? We know there's going to be a chart topper tomorrow. We might not know what it is, but we know there'll be a threat with a CVSS-10 or whatever you want to call it. That's really hot sometime again. But we can also help the people out, and especially outside of security, understand these things in ways that are more sustainable. And I think that that sustainability of knowledge, that the right cubby holes, the right chunking of this is what someone needs to know, can enable them to learn. And when I say this is my next 10 years, I think of this as a volley in a conversation, right? I'm gonna see if this works. You get the mic drop effect. Didn't drop the microphone. I remember that blog post of yours.
Please don't drop the mic.
Please don't drop the mic. No, I dropped the book on my desk. I've got a little lav mic here. They're nowhere near each other. But I think
the mics were harmed in the creation of this episode.
I think the conversation around how do we think about what every engineer needs to know can move to what does a front-end developer need to know is different than what a back-end developer needs to know, is different than what an IoT dev needs to know, is different than an SRE. Yep. And I think there's commonality, right? The jazz, the rock and roll. And I think there's specifics. And I hope that we find ourselves in a conversation over time about what people need to know. And I want to encourage everyone who's listening today, who's thinking about building bridges, to think about not only participating in this as a conversation with blog posts, with posts on LinkedIn, but also think about it a little bit more deeply about writing papers, writing books, really doing the work of developing the knowledge, because I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done. And the work, like our work on the manifesto, is better in conversation than it is with me silly dropping the book on my desk to make a big splash.
I definitely agree with that. Now, one of the ways, and here's a perfect segue as we're just about to wrap up, but I do want to touch on this. One of the ways I love to encourage the conversation is by standing up in front of rooms of people and yammering on and on about my ideas, because they like to come and challenge me afterwards. And I'm guessing you get that same thing, but I know you've got a keynote coming up in the Pacific Northwest. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. And I didn't title it just for you, but I love the title of the podcast. So the title of my upcoming talk at AppSec PNW, AppSecPacificNorthwest.org, it's going to be in Portland June 10th, the title is From Tacoma Narrows to West Seattle, A Century of Pacific Northwest Bridges. And I'm going to look at the history of bridges, starting with Tacoma Narrows, coming through more recent problems we've had here in Seattle with the West Seattle Bridge, which was closed for a year, and ask what we can learn from that. And this is more than metaphor. There's some very specific changes going to the Biden administration's executive order on cybersecurity through the new national cybersecurity strategy, which are going to change how we deliver software. They've already started to, and I'm going to talk about that. And so I'm really looking forward to the conference. It's a nice small conference. It's a great chance to meet your fellow practitioners around the Pacific Northwest if you live in the region. It's an OWASP conference organized, I believe, by the Portland, Seattle, Vancouver, and Victoria OWASP chapters jointly. And again, June 10th, appsecpnw.org.
Very cool. We'll put that in the comments and all the happy places too, just to make sure y'all have access to that. So unfortunately, we've reached that time. We've got to wrap things up. But Adam, I really appreciate you joining us. It's been a real, real blast talking to you. And I mean, every time we chat, I feel like we dig into some pretty cool topics. And this was definitely no different. So thanks for coming on. And thank all of you for joining us once again. We're here. I'll keep bringing the show as you keep telling me who you want to see, or you know, what you want us talking about here, whatever. I'll keep coming. The guests just keep. I'm still astounded by how great our guests have been on this show. So I'm very fortunate. Hopefully you're enjoying it too. And we'll be back next week with another show. Until then, take care. We'll see you next time on Securing Bridges.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Securing Bridges podcast with Alyssa Miller. If you learned something new and this podcast made you think, then share itspmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey.
You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.